Guy spoke the other night in his talk on Unentangled Knowing about the central links of the chain of dependent origination, and said something like he wasn't going to go into the other areas because that can raise a lot of philosophical debates and be too complicated. Well, I think tonight is a bit of a case of fools rush in where angels fear to tread, but I thought I would try to give a bit of what is just by necessity an outline or an overview of this teaching of dependent origination, but really to touch on a little bit why it might raise some philosophical debates, but to mainly present it as a teaching that is very practical and actually can be helpful for us as meditators and in our lives. But because it's complicated, you do have a handout, maybe the most exciting thing that's happened today. You have a handout, something to read with a picture on it. But there's not actually that many words. It's quite a complicated picture, but that's what we'll be looking at tonight. And you don't even need to have the handout to listen and learn, hopefully, from this talk. But just because there is so many details in this, rather than trying to grasp after them as they're going by, I think it's simpler just to have it written down. And on the side that has the most words on it with the circles, I also put some references for you to explore if you're interested at the end of the retreat, some books that I've found helpful, and also some sutta references to this teaching. So we'll be looking at this overview, this sheet handout tonight. So the Buddha himself said that dependent origination was his most profound insight. There are many ways in which we talk about the teachings of the Buddha and what are the most central ones. We can talk about the Four Noble Truths or the Three Characteristics. But he himself basically equated the centrality of his teaching with this teaching on dependent origination. He said something like, "One who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. One who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination." So he himself saw them as interwoven, inseparable, that this teaching is really very powerful and central to the way he understood the world, and especially the way we suffer and can find freedom. But when he had this realization, this insight into dependent origination, and there's a few ways in which the Pali word is paticca-samuppada. At the top of the handout, there's a few different ways that it's translated: dependent co-arising, conditioned co-production. I might use them interchangeably tonight. He had this insight as part of his awakening, as he sat under the Bodhi tree and in the days afterwards, really reflecting on the nature of suffering, how it's created, how it's caused, how it's continued. But he saw that this was a deep and complicated teaching. And this is what he said: "Monks, the thought arose in me thus. This truth which I have realized is profound, difficult to see, abstruse, calming, subtle, not attainable through mere sophisticated logic." So it's not just something you can think about. It is something to be experienced and practiced with. "But beings revel in attachment, take pleasure in attachment, and delight in attachment. For beings who thus revel, take pleasure and delight in attachment, this is an extremely difficult thing to see. That is the law of conditionality, the principle of dependent origination. Moreover, this also is an extremely difficult thing to see. The calming of all conditioning, the casting off of all clinging, the abandoning of desire, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. If I were to give this teaching and my words were not understood, that would simply make for weariness, difficulty, and vexation." So he really had a sense that most people not only couldn't, but perhaps even wouldn't want to understand this teaching. But luckily for us, it said that a Brahma god from the Brahma realms came down and implored him to teach, said, "Oh Lord, there are people out there with but little dust on their eyes who maybe will understand." And so he did start to teach. And this was one of the central things that he taught over the many years, gave many teachings on it. The sutta references are there for you to look up. This is from the Mahanidana Sutta sometime later. Thus have I heard that on one occasion the Blessed One was living among the Kurus. Now the Kurus have a town named Kamasadamma. There the Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One, and on arrival, having bowed down to the Blessed One, sat to one side. Now, I think you've heard us talk about Ananda before. You probably know a little about him. He was the Buddha's cousin and an attendant for the last 25 years of the Buddha's life. A very wonderful being, but during the lifetime of the Buddha, not fully enlightened. And there's a whole story about that. I might have mentioned it this time. But anyway, he's a very sincere practitioner, very wise in many ways, very compassionate, but often a little slow. And so often when he's interacting with the Buddha's having to say, So here Ananda is trying again. And he says, as he was sitting here, he said to the Blessed One, "It's amazing, Lord, it's astounding how deep this dependent co-arising is and how deep its appearance is. And yet to me, it seems as clear can be." So you kind of know this is not going to go well. There's a little bit of hubris there. And the Buddha says, "Don't say that, Ananda, don't say that. Deep is this dependent co-arising, and deep is its appearance. It's because of not understanding and not penetrating this Dhamma that this generation is like a tangled skein, a knotted ball of string, like matted rushes and reeds, and does not go beyond rebirth, beyond the plains of deprivation, woe, and bad destination." So he's basically saying, you know, don't treat this lightly. This teaching is very complicated, and not understanding it is why we're in this tangled web that Guy spoke about the other night. This theme of tangledness and getting out of the tangle, again, is throughout the Buddha's teaching. So it can seem complicated if you think of anything with 12 links to it, all the different levels at which it operates at. It can seem very complicated and hard to remember, hard to understand. But its essence is really simple. It's an explication of the first and second noble truths, the truth of suffering and the cause of suffering. And its basic theme is cause and effect, that all experience is conditioned. All of this relative world is conditioned. Again, these are the words of the Buddha. He says about this cause and effect, "When this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, this arises. When this does not exist, that does not come to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases." So it's just talking about what we can observe in our own experience, the causal or conditioned nature of experience, and how things are interdependent, how they are conditioned and affected by all of the things around them, not created independently. There is nothing in this conditioned realm that's self-created. It's all out of other causes and conditions. So this teaching is drawing that out. Instead of just saying cause and effect, it's really looking at all of the factors along a trajectory of a particular arising and how that might happen. And each one of these links could be a whole talk, because most of them have levels to them, they have different components, and their manifestations have depth to them. I'm just going to touch on them briefly, again, necessity of time, and really emphasize how it works, and particularly how I've come to understand this teaching and how to use it in practice, how it's been helpful to me. And as I said, just to know that if it does interest you, if you find it helpful, there are many resources you can look into when you leave the retreat. So on one side of the handout, as words in a few circles, the other side is this very graphic depiction, it's just a sketch of what's called the Bhavachakra, the wheel of life. And this is just a line drawing of what is usually depicted in the form of Tibetan you could say, art of a tanka. Many of you have seen tankas. We've got some of them hanging around. There's beautiful silk scrolls that have imagery in the center. And, it, you know, they've become pieces of art these days. People just buy them and hang them in their homes and don't know what they mean. But they're actually really intended to be teaching tools. And good tankas are very rich in meaning, and this one certainly is. It's hard to find actually good tankas, even of the Bhavachaka Wheel of Life, but it's even harder to find good line drawings that will come out in photocopies. So this is not a great one, but it's got all of the imagery there. And I'll just start by going through it, because these kind of graphic images are useful because they convey something that we can get on a different level than just hearing words. And there's reasons why all the different images have been chosen and used over these thousands of years as teaching tools. So I think it's helpful to understand what it's pointing to. So it's this very fearsome being holding what looks like a disc or a circle. That's the Lord of Death. That's Yama, with his skulls in his headdress and his fierce eyes and his fangs and his talons on his hands and his feet. And he's holding up this disc that looks like it's, you know, again, a, some kind of painting, but it's actually a mirror. What he's holding is a mirror, and it's just representing what's being shown in the mirror is life, is this cycle, this circle of life. Starting at the center, the three images are of a rooster, a snake, and a pig. And they each represent, the rooster is greed, the snake is aversion, and the pig is delusion. I actually disagree with that a little bit, but that's what it is traditionally. But what's interesting about them is they each have the other's tail in their mouths, and so they're just cycling around. So there's a lot of imagery about cycling and going in circles in this tanka. And of course, you'll recognize our three old friends, the kalesas. These are the torments of mind, the defilements, the sources of suffering. So they're there right at the center of the circle. And then to either side of that, there's a dark side and a lighter side. The dark side is beings going down, falling down into the hell realms, and then on the left side going up into the heaven realm. So again, that sense of cycling around, that this is right there at the center. And then the next level are six realms. In some understandings, there are many more realms than that in the Buddhist cosmology, but if we distill it down to just these six, we can relate to them not just as abstract or mythological, even archetypal realms, but states of mind that we can know as human beings, and I think that's why they're helpful to kind of understanding this way. If you look at the realm that's at the top, you could say at 12 o'clock in the cycle, that's the heaven realms. And there are, I think, 26 different levels of heaven realms, but they're just distilled here into one. And so that's where the devas and the brahmas and the gods live, in these realms just of pure pleasure. Nothing difficult happens until they end. And that's another whole teaching about what happens then. But, you know, they're playing music and they're wandering around. And I always think this is a very Californian kind of heaven realm, because they've got a hot tub of some kind there. I don't know if that's actually in the heaven realms, but they're swimming and they're singing. And it's meant to be just a place of delight, of pleasure, of no unskillful mind states, no aversive mind states. I shouldn't say unwholesome. It's a place of pleasure. You know, they just eat delicious food, and their bodies are often bodies of light, etc. As you go clockwise around the circle, it's another kind of heaven realm, but this is the realm of the asuras, or the angry gods. And it's so interesting, they have a whole realm for this. These are beings that have a lot of energy and a lot of skill and a lot of power, but they're always warring. They're always fighting each other, and even sometimes trying to fight the devas and go to those realms and cause trouble. And so you can kind of get a sense of that kind of being. I think of politicians and businessmen, kind of in that, always wanting, you know, bigger, better, more, mine, you know, wanting what other people have. But we know that kind of mind state, that kind of aggression and fierceness. As you go further around, the next realm is the animal realm. And again, just the realm of all the different forms and shapes of animals that there are on the planet. Each of these realms is categorized by a particular quality of mind. And for the animal realm, it's basically delusion. It's that sense of not having in that incarnation the possibility of awakening, that there's not the wisdom factor there. Now, again, I love animals. I think there are some very intelligent animals, some more intelligent than some people one might know. But it's really just a kind of, again, archetypal understanding of that kind of mind, sort of a bit dull, not really able to be mindful, basically, to hear the Dhamma and practice, understand the Dhamma. So that's the animal realm. As you go around again, it's a hell realm. And this is, again, in its sketch, it's very simplistic. There are said to be hot and cold hells, and in some tankas that have a lot of detail in them, this can be very graphic here. There's, you know, just scenes of a lot of suffering, all kinds of suffering happening in these realms. You can see flames and different things happening. It's just as well it's not too graphic. But we know that, you know, the hell realms of the mind and the heart, when we're really tormented, struggling, lost, confused, hurt, blaming, judging, this is a realm that we can know. And then further around, the next one going clockwise is a really interesting realm. And as I said, this is why it's kind of helpful to get these imagery. This is the realm of the hungry ghosts. And a hungry ghost, a preta, is a being that has a really big stomach, a little thin neck, and a pinhole kind of mouth. And so they can never get enough. And the depiction, you can kind of see them, they're always kind of going around. It's a bit like zombies, actually, isn't it? They're kind of looking to get something, looking to eat. They're never satisfied. Because it's impossible to put enough in this little mouth to feed this big belly. Anyone relate to that? I mean, this is what we do a lot of the time, this sense of not being satisfied, looking for something out there to quell this emptiness that we have. So that's the realm of the hungry ghosts. And then on top of that is the human realm. And it's got just various depictions of people at various ages, even someone meditating in bed, at home, whatever. And it's said that the human realm is the ideal realm, because in this realm there's the right balance of pleasure and pain, of suffering, and the ability for the mind to be released, to not suffer. And that's the optimum kind of balance to actually hear the Dhamma and wake up. So it's considered the best realm to be born in, to hear the Dhamma. And what I like about this particular version of the Tanka is in each one, there's a little circle with an image in it, and that's the Buddha teaching. And it's said that the Buddha is teaching the appropriate teaching for that realm, and he often has a mudra is appropriate, or he's bearing some kind of offering, has some kind of talisman or artifact that's useful in that realm. And so the teaching is that in all of these realms, if there is just even a seed of a waking up happening, that it's possible that people can, and that beings can come to awakening, because the Buddha is there teaching. So that's just, again, a very brief description of what's going on. Then we move to the outer section, and that's where the 12 links of dependent origination are shown. At the top, at 12 o'clock, is usually where it begins, and I'll talk more about this sense of beginning and endings and the cycle later on, but we have to start somewhere. So we start with ignorance, and that's there at 12 o'clock, and it's usually a blind person, someone there with a stick trying to find their way, of ignorance or avidya. It's really important to know that when we talk about delusion or ignorance, it's not an IQ test. It doesn't mean, you know, intelligence, or that we're dumb or smart or whatever. It really is about not knowing the truth of things, how things work in this sort of level of Dhamma. Not knowing how suffering is caused, and certainly not knowing the end of suffering, the possibility of the end of suffering. So classic definitions of delusion or ignorance are not knowing the Four Noble Truths, not understanding the three characteristics, taking things to be permanent that are impermanent, taking things to be, identifying with a solid sense of self and thinking that that's permanent. These are all forms of ignorance and basically wrong view. Carol talked the other night about different forms of wrong view fueled by perception. This is the realm of ignorance or delusion. And it's a realm we are pretty familiar with, unfortunately, because we spend a lot of time acting out of these wrong views or this sense of delusion, this experience of delusion, not understanding karma, the teaching on karma, not understanding how the things that we do that we think will bring happiness actually bring us more suffering. And so this is that whole realm of not knowing why we're suffering and how to get out, thinking ourselves to be this solid, permanent self and trying to manipulate experience by getting more of what we want and pushing away what we don't want. We think that's how to get happiness, and that's just another form of delusion. So all the different ways we manipulate, we blame, we judge experience and make that the source of our suffering, rather than looking directly at our own minds and hearts and seeing how it's our very ignorance that's perpetuating this sense of being lost or caught in struggle. And it can happen in a moment, it can happen over, you know, long periods of time, this misunderstanding of the nature of things, not knowing, understanding the Dhamma. One just very simple experience that I have that's perhaps you can relate to it, given the noise of the construction that we've been practicing with all these weeks. I was spending a holiday in Hawaii, which is beautiful, as you know. It's sort of the, you know, this archetypal paradise kind of place. But as I said earlier, paradise isn't perfect. I was in this very nice place. The weather was beautiful. I got up early one morning, did yoga, and went to meditate, sitting in my place. And what started to happen was I heard this noise that I really didn't like. And what this noise was a bird. This is a bird called a francolin. And I'm, as I said earlier, I'm an animal lover, I'm a bird lover, I love to watch birds. But francolins I do not like for a number of reasons. One is they're an introduced bird. They're not native to Hawaii, actually. It's very rare to see native birds in Hawaii. It's really sad, especially around the coast. They're basically not there. So it's an introduced bird, and it has a really horrible call. You know, most birds, you think, oh, birds, cheep, 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 did a little, little. The francolin goes, and it just goes louder and louder and louder and louder and louder, and it's really loud. And I'm very sensitive to sounds. I can hear the slightest sound, you know, a pin dropping kind of thing. So I can just hear the chair actually rattling. I couldn't hear Carolyn. She knows about me and francolins. So there I am meditating, and this noise starts happening. So what does my mind do? They shouldn't be here. You know, they don't belong here. It's a horrible sound. How can I meditate with that sound outside my window? You know, so I'm just getting more and more agitated trying to meditate, and all of a sudden I'm up out of my seat, out the door, you know, round the corner, looking for it. I had a stone in my hand ready, and I knew I wouldn't hit one, but, you know, that kind of energy out of that belief, you know, as I said, it was all of those things. They shouldn't be, that was the big one. They shouldn't be, why are they even here, you know? Why are they even here? You know, the poor Francolins, they just got born there. They don't have some sense of, you know, they're not Hawaiian birds. Why are they even here? They shouldn't be, and they shouldn't make that sound. Anytime you get into that mind state, I mean, it's suffering, right? And it wasn't until I was out there ready, you know, like, ah, the dragolins. I'm like, what am I doing? I was meditating, you know, meditating. Luckily, none of you have gone out there with the same kind of energy to our poor workmen, but the Franklin survived that day. So I just, it was very humbling, you know, to actually put the stone down, go back, and just sit and feel, you know, what I had done to my body and my mind out of that sense of what's right and what's wrong. And we do it all the time. So got through that meditation, the day went on, a very pleasant day. Next day, same routine, get up early, yoga, sit, Franklin's. But this time, because I had the awareness, you know, of what happens when I don't see what the mind does, it was just sound. It was unpleasant, but it was just sound. This is ignorance, though. When we take up something, hold on to it, and make it into something permanent, something wrong, have to fix it, have to get rid of it, don't like it. This is, you know, woven through at the way we relate to experience. So very central. And of course, the challenge of ignorance is when we're in it, we don't realize it. It's the very nature of delusion to confuse us, to make us believe that what we're thinking and feeling is the absolute truth, is the only possible response to this situation. You know, Franklins sound terrible. That's just the truth. You know, they shouldn't be here. That's just the truth. We take it up and we make it solid. She loves Franklins. So, ignorance could go, you know, we give whole talks sometimes on delusion and ignorance because it's so important, but the cycle goes on to sankharas, volitional formations. And the classic image for this, in different tantras you'll find different images used, they're not always the same, but the classic image is a potter. Someone making pots. And sankharas, Guy talked about them in his talk on the aggregates. It's part of the aggregates, volitional formations, it's often translated as. But it's of thought, word, and deed. It's any action of thought, word, and deed done with intention. And so the image of the potter is a great one. Out of this kind of glob, this inchoate mass, something gets shaped that becomes solid. And this is really what we do with these volitional formations. As we act them out, and especially thought, word, and deed, they get more solid. You know, thought has less weight, word has impact, deed even more impact. But we solidify. We solidify out of these intentional actions, and we create conditioned patterns. This is a whole realm of conditioning and habits, and you can see how, you know, it shapes our personality, forms our sense of what's right and what's wrong, and what we like and don't like is all in this realm of sankhara. And so again, an important aspect of this whole cycle. Goes on to the third link, which is consciousness, vijnana. Again, it's an aggregate, so Guy spoke about it the other night. Using consciousness in this very simple sense of consciousness at one of the six sense doors. Smelling consciousness, tasting consciousness, sensing, hearing, touching, and the mind. And it's interesting that the image that's usually given for consciousness is a monkey. So even in these very traditional teachings, they called it monkey mind, you know, the mind, and it's usually reaching out, it's grasping at some fruit, so it's looking for sense contact, consciousness, going out and getting sense contact. The next in the links is nama rupa. And this is an interesting one. Greg mentioned it a little bit in one of his talks earlier on. The usual translation is name and form, or mind and body, mentality, materiality. The image is two people in a boat. And so it's just a sense of two people kind of being carried along together, this union or the united nature of mind and body, how they influence each other. Sometimes this is seen as shorthand for the aggregates, because if you remember the aggregates, there's one physical one, rupa, And then the four mental ones of feeling, perception, sankharas, and consciousness. It's a little bit different, though, in this understanding. Nama Rupa is a little different. The factors within the Rupa is form, so it's the shorthand or the description of it is the four physical elements of earth, air, fire, and water. The nama part, the mental part, is feeling, perception, intention, contact, and attention. Again, you don't have to remember all these, it's a long list, but I've always been a little curious why these particular aspects in this particular list. And so I heard once it was kind of the orienting aspect of the mind. If you look at them, feeling, perception, intention, contact, attention, it's all about that relating to experience and kind of orienting to what's happening. And I think that's part of why it's in this sequence, in this teaching, with that as its understanding. It's how our mind perceives and understands, relates to the immediate experience. The next in the links is the six sense bases. Again, Guy has talked about that. These are the five physical senses in the mind. The usual image is of a house with, it's often five windows and a door, just that sense of the body with these basically openings or receptors for the outside world to come in. Often in some clearer depictions than this one, there's a monkey peering out through one of the windows, and it's kind of like consciousness looking out through the door or the window of perception onto the world. So it's just this simple, the six sense bases. Now it starts to get interesting. The next in the links is contact. And this is where Guy started his teaching the other night. So I'll go over a bit the same ground, but it really is some of the most important parts of this teaching. So it's worth repeating. Contact, passa. The image is of a man and woman embracing. They don't pull any punches in these images. You know, it's really like, what's, you know, one of the most intense things we can have is two people embracing, to, you know, being intimate with someone. So this is what they depict for consciousness. And it's something happening at one or more of the six sense doors. So basically, contact is something happening. And as we've talked about in this area, it's helpful to see there's actually three things happening. There's the organ of perception, so say the ear, and we know the physical ear, and it's kind of the way that it works. There's a sound that arises, and then there's the knowing of the sound. These are actually three different things, three different aspects of that experience. As meditators, this can become interesting to actually tease that apart a little. It's not something you can do just out of intention. It's very subtle, but to actually see the difference between the arising of an experience, say a sound, and the knowing of it. These are two different experiences. You can get a sense of this just through how we relate to the breath. I mean, as long as we're alive, we're breathing, right? It's happening all the time. Yet you know what a difference it is to be mindful of the breath. You know, and sometimes the breath is in the background. You kind of know you're breathing, but you're not really clear. You're like, oh, right, the breath. And then it's a very different experience. This is this realm of contact and the knowing of something that's happening. From contact arises vedana or feeling tone. Again, this is pivotal. We've talked a lot about it, that pleasant, unpleasant, neutral kinds of feeling tone. Could give a whole talk about feeling tone and its importance in our practice. The image is a very strong one. It's a person with an arrow through their eye or in their eye. It really points to this impingement or this, we're being struck by the vedana, you know, that has such an effect on us. And, you know, it's quite gruesome, an arrow in the eye. We've talked a lot about this. And why it's important is, of course, that if we don't notice it, the pleasant feeling tone leads to grasping, unpleasant feeling tone, we try to push away, and the neutral, we space out, we're dull, or we just start looking for the next hit, because neutrality isn't okay. Neutrality doesn't satisfy us. We want something more. So we actually actively look for something to latch onto. So it still perpetuates the wheel of craving. So the next link is the one of craving. We've talked again about this tanha. It's the second noble truth as the cause of suffering. I think someone has said that tanha, the Pali word is tanha, the literal meaning is thirst. But it's not just like everyday thirst, it's unquenchable thirst. It's this recognition that it's sort of like the hungry ghost, never satisfied, a thirst that cannot be quenched, a thirst that cannot be calmed or slaked. This is what's being pointed to here. So the image is of someone pouring someone else a cup of tea. So that's thirst, having a drink. What's interesting is when we get to this place, this is where wisdom can come in, or practice can come in, or choice can come in. Everything else is kind of set. It is conditioned, but as it moves along in the moment, there's not a lot we can do, right? You know, to contact. Contact keeps coming. You know, we can change our environment or whatever, but we'll still always be having some form of contact. And then the immediacy of the Vedana, the feeling tone. But here's the choice point of whether it goes to craving or not. And so it gets more volitional now. In craving, there are traditionally three kinds. Kama, tanha, sense desire, craving just for only pleasant sense experiences. Bhava, tanha, craving for becoming, craving to create a sense of self, craving to make things me and mine. And vibhava, tanha, craving to not exist, not wanting. I don't want this. I don't want me. I don't want me to be like this. I don't want my anger. I don't want this sadness. This is all still in the craving realm, vibhava tanha, not wanting. And so this is the whole field of the noble truths and how suffering gets created. If we think that grasping is going to do it for us, we're going to keep grasping, even though time and time again we see that it doesn't. We grasp something and it no longer creates that sense of happiness. We think if we had that or this person, this experience, that job, that relationship. And yet time and time again, we've gotten what we thought we wanted, and maybe it brought some happiness, but it was temporary. We had to actually have a different relationship to that experience to really understand happiness. But this belief that out there somewhere is the source, potential source of my happiness. I mean, once you start to look at the mind, you see how much it's driven by that. I spoke about it in my talk on restlessness, how we're just always thinking that the grass is greener, that I just haven't quite got it right, put everything, you know, in order yet. I haven't put enough energy into this yet. If I just tried a little harder, then I'd get the happiness that I'm looking for. And it sounds ridiculous when we say it that way, but if you look at our actual actions, this is a lot of what's happening. One of my favorite sources of wisdom these days is Calvin and Hobbes cartoons, mainly Hobbes. You know, Calvin is the everyman, he's us, and Hobbes is the voice of wisdom. So here's Calvin and his pontificating on this theme. For those of you that don't know, Calvin and Hobbes, cartoon figures. Calvin's his little boy, Hobbes is his imaginary tiger, and Calvin's always getting into trouble. So this is Calvin saying, "Getting is better than having. When you get something, it's new and exciting. When you have something, you take it for granted and it's boring." But Hobbes says, "But everything you get turns into something that you have." Calvin says, "That's why you always need to get new things." And Hobbes says, "I feel I'm in a stockholder's dream." Calvin, "Waste and want, that's my motto." And again, there, you know, it's really going to the heart. This whole economy is built on that. You know, get new things. This one's old. It's, you know, a year old. It's out of date. You need more. You need better. You need this new thing. And the whole cycle of wanting and craving is all around that kind of mind state of it's out there somewhere. So this leads inevitably, if there's not clear seeing, to the next link, which is clinging. So it's just, it's a very subtle movement. Grasping, we're reaching out. Clinging, we've got it, and we're holding on to it. The image is often a person, in this case, it's picking fruit. Sometimes the monkey is there, the one picking the fruit, but it's like grasping and clinging. Just a sequence that happens. It's more solidifying of the experience. And it's almost inevitable. It's very rare that we don't grasp and then cling. Because that's the whole point, isn't it? I grasp it and then I hold on. I want to keep it until, like Hobbes, you know, I'm on to the next thing. But we only let go when the new thing comes that we grasp onto. So it's usually inevitable. And it's more solid. There's a whole sort of solidifying nature to this part of the cycle where what we grasp onto as we cling to it becomes mine. I become identified, you know, it's my experience, it's my object, it's my iPhone, it's my whatever, you know, that we've identified with. And what that leads to is the next link, which is becoming. And that, you know, I was just, you could see how this slides in from the clinging, this is mine, to identification. I'm an owner of an iPhone. What kind of phone do you... Oh, you don't have an iPhone. You know, it's however we've identified it. We've taken this thing up, and now it becomes part of who we are. And again, it's a sequence. The image is of becoming. Sometimes it's a pregnant woman. Here in this one, it's a couple making love, and that sense of, you know, new beginnings possibly happening. And so it's just more and more solidification. I've said, this is mine, now it's who I am, and I'm getting more and more identified, solid about that as my relationship. And so inevitably, to birth, the images of a woman giving birth. And it sort of completes that cycle of becoming. More from the craving, clinging, becoming, to birth. It's just most of the time this is happening so quickly we don't even see the different aspects of the experience. It's just really quick. Where we can sometimes notice this, most of the time we're liking this. It's like, oh yes, you know, this is mine. Unless it's an unpleasant. I think Guy talked about, you know, when it's an unpleasant birth, then we want the ending as pleasant. When it's a pleasant birth, the ending is unpleasant. So it depends. But most of the time, just because of the stickiness of our minds, we hold on. And so, you know, that solidification happens. And we don't even notice it's happening unless something comes along to challenge it, whether it's an unpleasant birth or someone, you know, does something that makes us feel insecure. This is all a lot around how we protect and defend. We've created this sense of self. It's solid. It's who I am. Therefore, there's barriers between you and me. And, you know, maybe I have what you want or you have what I want. But it's all around solidity, a sense of self, a feeling of separation, and having to protect and defend. This is the relationship that we get into. And you can just see in a day how many selves you take birth in. You know, the sleepy yogi, the tired yogi, the energetic yogi, the hungry yogi, the good yogi, the bad yogi, you know, for the meta-filled yogi, the grumpy yogi. And each one of those has a manifestation, a certain lifespan. But where was the tired yogi of this morning? Or the hungry yogi before lunchtime? You know, you eat and you're no longer hungry. All of these different manifestations arising and passing. But what's inevitable, once there's birth, there's death. And so the next link is that of old age, sickness, and death. It's shorthand or longhand, depending on how you look at it, for suffering. And the image, a very traditional one from Buddhist countries, of someone carrying a corpse to the burning ghats, to the burning pyre, the funeral pyre. So that's the image. They've actually got the corpse on their back carrying that dead body to be burnt, and that's the end of that cycle. We have so many ideas and strategies around suffering, of not wanting to experience suffering, and that's why the Buddha's teachings are so sometimes challenging, but really revelatory for us. It's actually, if we can understand our suffering, there's a chance to break that cycle even here. So instead of using our usual strategies of suffering, to turn towards suffering and begin to understand it. So this is the big view of dependent origination, or sorry, not the big view, very quick overview. As I said, each of these links, many levels to them that we could talk about, but I want to more talk about now the big picture of how it's understood and how we can relate to it in our practice. The traditional view of dependent origination, and now if you turn over to the one with the circles on it, the traditional view of dependent origination I have on the outside of those circles, where the first two links of ignorance and volitional formations are a previous life. They're the conditions out of which the momentum for rebirth into this existence was created. And then the links 3 through 10 of consciousness through becoming are considered to be happening in this lifetime. And then that becoming leads to a birth in a next lifetime. So that's the three lifetime model. And this is what Guy was talking about philosophical. You know, does this mean you have to believe in rebirth to have this be helpful? What is it? What is rebirth? What gets reborn? I'm not going there. I'm just saying this is what the Buddha taught and often usually spoke about dependent origination in that way. But as practitioners, and there are many teachings around this, there's a more direct, in this lifetime or even moment-to-moment way of understanding it that's much more helpful for us, that we can see, as I said, just the ways all of these forms of times of taking birth and dying are happening over and over again. So just to start with the whole sense of how I've depicted it here as a cycle, as a circle even. When the Buddha gave this teaching, he just gave it as a list. And it was a representation of his understanding, as I said, of how suffering gets created. Anytime you put insight or wisdom into words, it can make it seem more mechanical or literal than it actually is. And so you don't want to take it, you know, he's trying to point to something that's very complex. And so it seems like it's these little neat boxes, and it's not like that at all. It's much more complex than just a list of words, and even than a circle is. So a circle isn't actually such a good image for this. It's just kind of helpful to see the cyclical nature that there can be, but it's really much more complex than that, and that there are many cycles going on at any one time. One of the images I like to use for dependent origination is like if you took the cover off an old kind of watch where there are all these different gears and cogs, and they're different sizes, and some are going tick, 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 and some are going whirr, and some are really big and going quite slowly. That's much more like what's happening with dependent origination. And even that is a little limited. Thanissaro Bhikkhu talks about it being much more like fractals or holograms, where things are feeding back on themselves and happening in different time sequences. So one of the things that's really important to get is this is not like a clock. You know, ignorance, tick. Volitional formations, tick, tick, tick. Where they're all equal weight and equal time. Like ignorance doesn't stop. You move to volitional formations. It's not like it's ended and now you're just in volitional formations. Some of these things are happening all the time. And what the Buddha is just pointing to is pay attention to this particular part of your experience in this moment. And so time sequence, it's not just regular. They're not all happening in order as it's depicted here. They can be happening perhaps even all, you know, so quickly it seems like almost all at once. And the other important thing to get is it's not causal. So it's not that ignorance causes volitional formations, even though it has a big part to play in that, but ignorance conditions volitional formations. So it's getting back to that earlier little piece of a sutta that I read about cause and effect or conditional nature. As a Venerable Paiuto says, when ignorance is like this, volitional formations are like that. That's the relationship between these links that's important to get. Not that one causes the next, and as it causes the next, it kind of disappears. But they're often all acting at any one time. And we just, you know, just because of the nature of our minds, it's helpful for us to pick out a particular aspect and pay attention to that. So this is really important to get, that it's conditioned. So if I ring the bell, that's causal. The fact that I ring it, hit the striker on the bell. But how I ring the bell, loud or soft or whatever, that's the conditioning side of it. And that's the more important part of this. So to really sort of, if you have a kind of sense or, you know, and I'm reinforcing it here with this circle that it's only like that, please let that go. It's much more complex, all these different levels. But it helps us just to understand it. It's a way into it. So as an example of how this works, there's a book called, here somewhere. Twelve Steps on the Buddha's Path, Bill, Buddha, and We by Laura S. And she uses the Buddha's teachings to understand 12-step and addiction. And she said it was really helpful for her when she brought the understanding of dependent origination to her tendency to abuse alcohol. And this is a sequence of her drawing out what happened as she chose to do this again and again and again through the 12 links. I never intended to get drunk in social situations, ignorance, but I thought I could just have a few drinks and have a good time, mental formations. I imagined how much fun I would have, consciousness, when someone invited me to a party. I, material form, would go, to a party. I would see, sense gates, that everyone was drinking and having a good time. Someone would hand me a drink and I'd take the first sip, contact. A pleasant feeling would envelop me, feeling tone. I would want more of that feeling, more to drink, craving. I would have one drink after another, clinging, until I was drunk, being, throwing up in a blackout and humiliating myself. I would get sober and swear never to let that kind of behavior happen again, but I would go to another party, rebirth, as soon as there was an opportunity, and the whole cycle of drunkenness would play out again, perhaps this time with an automobile accident or an ended friendship. The realization that I had done it again made me despair, dukkha. So that was kind of a longer example of how it might happen. You know, that's obviously over some period of time, a few hours of a party, a few days or weeks of repeating that behavior. But these kind of cycles are happening all the time for us. This is the important thing to see, that wherever ignorance is playing a role, and until we're fully enlightened, it will, some cycle like this is playing out for us, whether it's happening in a moment, in the flash of an eye, through a solidification of a sense of self, or over a longer period of, it could be a few moments, a few hours, a day, you know, this retreat, you're the yogi who's on a 3-month retreat, you know, that's an identification. Or some longing that you have, you know, to get a different job or have a certain vacation. So it can play out over all these different periods of time. So why is this helpful to understand? Again, as we keep emphasizing, the more we understand our mind and how it plays out in this way, the more we can bring this choice point in. Christina Feldman says, to me, the significance of this whole description is that if we understand the way our world is created, we also then become conscious participants in that creation. So it's just, if there's more wisdom, there's less likelihood we'll get stuck. We'll get stuck in kinds of becoming that are suffering, basically. And Buddhadasa Bhikkhu describes it as the radiant wheel. Because as soon as you talk about suffering, if there's wisdom, if you start to understand it, you can start to understand the end of suffering. This is really important, that the very recognition of these tendencies of mind, and especially the area that Guy talked about, the contact, feeling, craving, if we can bring mindfulness in, then there's that possibility of shifting this whole cycle. But what I think is important is anywhere we recognize that we are on the chain, we actually have a chance to wake up. Practicing in the way we're doing is reducing to some great degree our level of ignorance. If you do that, there's not so much an impetus to have the other cycle keep going, or certainly not to keep going in a way that we're really oblivious to. We see what's happening. So we start to bring the wisdom in wherever we can wake up, to see that an unpleasant experience doesn't have to lead to craving, that we have more choice than we usually think we do. I remember a yogi on one retreat who was really obsessing about a certain thing on the retreat, you know, really obsessing about it. And something finally we said made a difference. And it was like the scales dropped, and she said, you mean I don't have to do that? She thought it was kind of the only response, that being obsessed and judging and wanting and fearful and angry and hurt, and that was the only response. And she could just shift that whole becoming that had been cycling through again and again and solidifying itself. So the cessation cycle, which the Buddha talked about, is just as important. He said, if there's no ignorance, there'll be no mental formations. We won't take a hold and deepen that conditioning. And then the whole thing kind of falls apart. Ajahn Sumedho puts it like this. He says, if you start with ignorance, you'll end up with suffering. It's that clear. But he says, I encourage you to start not from avidya, ignorance, but from awareness, vidya, and wisdom, panya. Be that wisdom itself, rather than a person who isn't wise trying to become wise. As long as you hold to the view that I'm not wise yet, but I hope to become wise, you'll end up with grief, sorrow, despair, and anguish. It's that direct. It's learning to trust in being the wisdom now, being awake, even though you may feel emotionally inadequate, doubtful or uncertain, frightened or terrified of it. Be the wisdom now. He's really talking about trusting our inner knowing, not in that deluded way, but this direct experience where we can know for ourselves, this is suffering. And this is the end of suffering. As Ajahn Chah says, there's the kind of suffering that leads to more suffering and the kind of suffering that leads to the end of suffering. That we can know this for ourselves. We can actually be in our experience in a way that leads to freedom and happiness rather than perpetuating these cycles of craving and clinging and becoming in a way that leads to suffering. And I'll end with the words of the Buddha, who said, for some people, contact, the point where sense plus object meet, is enthralling. And so they are washed by the tides of being, drifting along an empty, pointless road. Nowhere is there any sign of broken chains. But others come to understand their sense activity, and because they understand it, the stillness fills them with delight. They see just what contact does, and so their craving ends. They realize the total calm, The calm comes from the end of grasping. So let's just sit quietly for a moment. Thank you for your attention. And if this seems too complicated, please just let it drop. Put the paper away. But I have there's one thing I didn't get to say tonight, so I'm going to add a little more tomorrow morning when I lead the sitting. So you might keep it for tonight. Put it away tomorrow.